From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, influential labor rights activist Dolores Huerta reflects on her activism as outlined in a new documentary called Dolores, and singer-songwriter David Crosby discusses his latest album, Sky Trails. But first, the impact of the 9/11 terror attacks are still being felt 16 years later from America's approach to national security, to the health challenges faced by first responders. Russ Feingold is the former Democratic senator for Wisconsin. He held office during 9/11 and was a vocal critic of the government's response to those attacks. He was also the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. He's now a visiting professor at Yale Law School and the founder of a new voting rights group called Legit Action. He joins us now to reflect on how 9/11 changed our nation. Senator Feingold, good to have you back on this program, my friend.
Tavis, it's great to be back on. Thank you.
Take me back all those years ago now and describe for me as best you can what it felt like being the lone vote against that Patriot Act.
I can't help but think about what it was like to be across the street from the Capitol and to see people fleeing and wondering if the Capitol was going to be hit. What I do remember more than anything else, because I was able to attend the singing of the song God Bless America on the steps of the Capitol with Republicans and Democrats alike that night. I recall the feeling of unity that lasted for a little while. I mean, it really was impressive. And at this time in our country, there is so much disunity. We've really forgotten what it is to come together to try to solve our problems. So obviously, the main thing is remembering those who were killed and hurt on 9/11. But also to rededicate ourselves to try to get back together to some kind of sense of community in this country. We've got to do that.
Does it always require, will it always take something as disastrous as 9/11 to bring us together as Americans? Why is it that we can't seem to do that around something that doesn't seem to literally take lives?
I mean, that's really troubling because, of course, in the past with the Depression and World War II, there are moments when people came together. And we've got to learn the lesson that you have to be ready for those kinds of disasters and problems by having strong institutions. And what's happening, and frankly, it started even before Donald Trump, a lot of our basic institutions, from voting rights to our campaign finance system to the way we elect the president to our Supreme Court, you name it, all of these are being attacked and they're being delegitimized. And the reason I created this group, Legit Action, is to say, remember, these attacks started in about 2009, 2010, before Donald Trump. And Tavis, they're going to keep going after Donald Trump, even though, frankly, Donald Trump couldn't be much worse. These attacks on democracy and on unity started before him. And we've got to be very vigilant about that in addition to all the things he's trying to pull.
I want to come back to the democracy being under threat, if I can put it that way, in just a second. But let me go back to the question I asked a moment ago, which is what you recall and what kind of response you received 16 years ago when you were the lone guy standing against this Patriot Act.
Yeah, I voted for the Afghanistan invasion after we were able to narrow the use of military force provision there, so it wasn't abused as much as it might have been, although some have abused it. But then they tried to jam through this bill and they named it the USA Patriot Act. And, you know, I was chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee. I thought maybe I better read it. So I read it. And I found out that it was really an attempt to do a lot of things depriving Americans of their freedoms that had more to do with drug cases than terrorism. I mean, even Bob Novak, the late conservative commentator, Tavis, said that it was an old wish list of the FBI. So I tried to sound the alarm that this thing was basically taking advantage of a terrorist attack to get some other agendas taken care of. And I decided to protest by voting no. I wasn't able to stop it, but it did help galvanize a national opposition to this that was, frankly, even stronger sometimes in some of the most conservative states in the union, like Montana or Idaho or Alaska, as well as the more liberal areas, because people sometimes get unified on not wanting the government intruding onto completely innocent behavior.
And what do you make, Senator Feingold, of my word here, not yours, the attacks and the increase, I should say, in those attacks on what many of us regard as civil liberties that need to be protected? If 16 years ago was, you know, a first strike against those civil liberties. What do you make of where we are 16 years later?
Well, there's always been strikes against civil liberties throughout our history that we've had to push back, from the, you know, Alien and Sedition Acts under John Adams way back at the beginning of the country, to the detention of Japanese Americans, and of course the abuses during the Bush years. But now we have a president who seems reckless in this regard. If some of these civil liberties get in his way, he just uses a very extreme rhetoric, such as his travel ban and his attempts to try to prevent people to come in from this country in an illicit way. So unfortunately, we have a chief executive of this country who doesn't seem to respect this. And the Congress has been very weak-kneed on this, so they're not likely to stand up to him as much as they should. And so we're in a very dangerous point here in terms of the repair that was attempted, at least in some cases, under the Obama administration.
I used a phrase a moment ago that our democracy is under attack. I don't want to put words in your mouth, and you wouldn't let me do that anyway. You certainly have a mind of your own. But how would you describe the fragile nature of our democracy? How would you frame what's happening to our democracy these days in your own words?
You know, I don't think I have to edit what you said. Otherwise, I just might add the word extreme attack. I consider a political movement in this country, the conservative Republican movement's attack on people's right to vote, from gerrymandering to not letting felons vote, to the Citizens United decision, which has created a monstrosity of our campaign finance system, to having two out of our three last presidents elected who weren't really the people that got the most votes, to essentially stealing the Supreme Court by taking President Obama's seat that he was entitled to fill when Justice Scalia died. This is a severe attack. In addition to the obvious problems that occurred during the election with Russian interference, I mean, I can't imagine a time when more aspects of our democracy have been directly under attack internally by our own government, by our own president in the Oval Office, as well as the members of Congress and politicians who are trying to repress the votes of blacks, Latinos, and others by using very nasty tactics so they can win elections.
So what happens then if the loyal opposition, in this case that would be the Democrats, can't seem to get their act together? What happens? How far does this story go?
Oh, we already found out what happens. You end up with somebody like Donald Trump. You know, even though obviously he didn't get the most votes and so on.
Right.
No, we have got to come forward, Davis, with a principled progressive agenda that takes on the big interest, takes on big money, takes on the people that control this system. But when we do, and the reason I created this group called Legit Action, let's appeal to those things that used to not be partisan. Nobody used to mess around with people's right to vote in the last 20, 30 years in any serious way. Nobody really thought corporations should be able to spend all they could on elections. And so these are things that we want to see if we can persuade people in the middle, maybe a number of Republicans, to say, wait a minute, let's get back to where we could at least agree on some common institutions and some common norms and some common traditions. I'd say coupling that with a strong, progressive, unified message against the dangers of powerful big interests in our country and around the world is the way to go. We can't do it by being sort of semi-Republican or half-Republican.
Right. So I think, let me take those 2 points, Senator Feingold. I think that we could make some progress on getting that unified progressive message. I think Bernie Sanders showed that it can happen, that you can raise a lot of money from small donors, that people do care, that a lot of us on the left aren't just completely wrapped around the finger of the Democratic Party or who the standard bearer might be that they're putting in front of us. So I think you can get a legitimate, if I can use your word, progressive response. What concerns me, though, is the other point you raise about getting some Republicans to take a look at this again. I just don't see those moderate Republicans that were in the Senate when you were there, moderate Republicans in the Senate prior to your being there. You're either on one extreme or you're on the other extreme. How many moderate Republican senators do you know?
Well, you know, a few of them are sticking their heads up a little bit. I'm a little bit encouraged with Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski did, along with Senator McCain on the health bill. Was encouraging. On some civil liberties issues, Senator Murkowski of Alaska has shown some willingness to work. I noticed that Senator McCain actually intervened in the United States Supreme Court case on reapportionment that actually is based on Wisconsin's malapportionment. And that was really kind of a surprise. So, you know, you don't need 20 Republicans. All you need is 2 or 3. And that changes the entire dynamic because the Senate is still very close. So I think you're even going to find some conservatives who are very uncomfortable with some of the things Donald Trump's doing, this appeal to race, this appeal to anti-Semitism, and all the different things he's been involved with or been unwilling to condemn. I think you're going to find a number of Republicans who aren't even liberals or moderates coming to help on some of these issues.
Let me close on this note as we have this conversation commemorating the anniversary. What say you, Senator Feingold, is the message all these years later about remaining vigilant, about how to make America better from within, as well as avoiding and being aware of those attacks coming from outside our borders?
Yeah, I don't think we got it completely right on either the international or domestic side after 9/11. Internationally, we kind of got into this idea that you kind of go after an organization like this sort of one country at a time, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. We sort of failure to sort of sustain an understanding of how this kind of an organization works or the various organizations that have succeeded it. So that has to improve, and our foreign policy has to be a little smarter and a little more comprehensive. On the domestic side, we made a lot of mistakes, including the attacks on civil liberties that we were just talking about, sometimes not standing up for Muslim Americans, Asian Americans, South Asians, and others who have been stereotyped and made to feel uncomfortable in this country. That is no way to counter these kinds of problems. And so we need to reinvigorate a sense of inclusion and the idea that America is a country for everybody, and that just about everybody here is patriotic, and we welcome each other with open arms as Americans, instead of trying to divide us against each other, as our current president has tried to do.
Students at Yale Law School are fortunate to hear your insights and wisdom for the time that you were there. Thank you for your vote 16 years ago, and as always, thank you for being on this program to share your insights, Senator Feingold.
Great to be with you, Tavis. Thanks.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Dolores Huerta is an important figure in the labor rights movement. She co-founded the National Farm Workers Association with Cesar Chavez in the 1960s and continues to speak out on social justice issues. She was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama in 2012. She's now the subject of a new documentary called Dolores. Before our conversation, let's listen to a clip from the film.
There were very, very few Latinos, and I'm talking about men, in the legislature in California in the 50s and 60s. It was all white men, and here you have someone like Dolores Huerta. That was just, people just didn't do that in those days.
We had one piece of legislation to take away the requirement that you had to be a U.S. citizen to get public assistance. I took parents whose kids had served in World War II to this one senator who was key for us to get that legislation. Sat them in his office with the pictures of their kids in uniform. They couldn't speak English. Senator Kobe couldn't speak Spanish. But I told him, just stay here until he says yes, that he'll vote on that bill.
You know, when I watch this documentary, Dolores, it's hard for me to sort of juxtapose the fights that you had to fight 50 years ago with the fights that you're still fighting 50 years later. I think about what President Trump did on DACA. Like, how do you process looking at what you were doing then and how in so many ways it's the same story a half a century later?
Well, I think you just have to, you know, keep moving forward, mm-hmm. and look back at the successes and the laws that we were able to pass and just know that eventually we're going to win. But we just have to, you know, not get depressed by the moment. And as an organizer, I always think this is an organizing opportunity, mm-hmm. because now the racism is very visible. They've taken off the hoods, mm-hmm. as Al Sharpton used to say, you know, you can see their faces, and mm-hmm. they are declaring themselves and what their intentions and their beliefs are. And so that means that we have to say to everybody, everybody's got to come in now at the public level, at the private level. Everyone has to engage to make sure that we end the racism in our society, that we put into our school books, you know, who built this country? Mm-hmm. Native Americans, who were the first slaves. African slaves who built the White House and the Congress. Mexicans and Filipinos and Chinese and Japanese and people from India that built the infrastructure of these United States. But if we don't get that into our school books, then children of color will never have the dignity to know that they are you know, citizens of this country. And my kids, you know, they will always think that somehow, you know, their people from Europe did it all. So I think it's imperative that we really have to start insisting we want the true story of the United States, because it's not just about our country, it's about the whole world. You know, 75% of the people in this world are people of color. You know, they're not Anglos, they're not white.
When you heard that Trump had made this decision on DACA, I mean, he had threatened this during the campaign, so no surprise there on some level. But when you heard that he was going to roll back what President Obama had done, how did that strike you?
Well, you know, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I think you've got like 70% of the people in the United States that support the DACA students. The fact that he said he was going to refer to the Congress, I think that there's a Republican strategy at work here, and I think that they're going to try to divide the community. They're going to say to the DACA students, okay, we'll let you stay here, but at the same time, we're going to be passing these laws in the Congress to triple the penalties of people that, you know, that cross the border. You know, and so I think that's some deviant strategy at work here. And I believe that with the Democratic governors and attorney generals that are taking this to court, because this is a civil rights violation, because they're targeting a particular group of people who happen to be of Mexican descent. 70% of the DACA students are Mexicans. And so I think at the we're going to win, I think, in terms of the DACA students being able to stay here. But I do believe that the Republicans are going to try to use this to try to either, you know, quell the Latino vote, make it look like they're actually doing something for them, and at the same time, you know, passing laws that are very punitive against the undocumented.
Help me understand, since you said it was a Republican strategy, help me understand strategically how it is that the Republican president with the Republican Congress can scapegoat an entire community and somehow think that when they run for re-election that they can pick up votes in that particular community. I just don't understand how anyone could be a Chicano of Hispanic descent and vote for somebody who's doing what they are attempting to do. So strategically, politically, I don't understand the math behind that.
Well, I think that they're being very short-sighted. All they have to do is look to see what happened in California with Proposition 187, which was a proposition that targeted immigrants and people of color, Latinos. And what happened, you know, the Republicans lost their base in California.
Right.
So they're kind
And haven't recovered yet.
They haven't recovered yet. Yeah. And I think that they're going to see that in the future. But I think those Latinos that did vote for the Republican Party, that voted for Trump, are people that are maybe vote because of the abortion issue, because of, you know, the Catholic Church was encouraging people, you know, not to vote for Hillary because of her position on abortion. And you have also the evangelicals that were also doing a very aggressive campaign, you know, for the Republican Party. And so I think one of the things that we have to do is normalize abortion, because we know that for the majority of women in the United States of America, that is a very, very strong issue. You know, that women have to control their own reproductive rights, you know, and this is a very important issue for all women, because you can't be liberated if you're a woman and if you can't have control over your own body.
But you can't see any way that the Republican Party would get a sizable slice of the Hispanic vote in 2020? Can you see that?
Well, you know, they do have an organization called Libre, which translated into English would mean free, you know, freedom.
Sure.
And they're doing a lot of work. And then what they do is they do services like driver's license classes and citizenship classes, kind of trying to woo the Latino population to their side.
Yeah.
But I think what happened with Arpaio, you know, them forgiving
the sheriff in Arizona.
Yeah, the sheriff in Arizona, after all of the discrimination that he did, the racial profiling, that I think that's going to turn the tide. And then also with the DACA students coming out against DACA.
Yeah.
And we have to just do a lot of organizing, I think, at the grassroots level to really inform and educate the Latino public.
So we were all of your friends celebrated you, and you received that Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama, a high moment in your life, I can only imagine. And so this documentary is powerful because it tells the beginnings of Dolores Huerta. So how did you get started on this road to being such an advocate?
Well, I met this great human being named Fred Ross Sr., and he's the one that got Cesar involved in San Jose, came to Stockton, and I was organizing a house meeting. And when I found out, wow, you can make this happen, you can actually, you know, make your public officials listen to you, bring in the kind of services that people need into their communities, send policemen to prison for beating up Mexican-American kids, I thought this is what I want to do, because I, like many kids of color, we were always being racially profiled, you know, just for walking down the street, coming home from a football game or a basketball game, and it was always so demeaning. Mm-hmm. And when I thought, wow, we can do something about this, we can do it by just getting people together, taking direct nonviolent action. And so I worked in a community service organization as a volunteer for many years. Then that's where I met Cesar. And we both had this thing in common about farm workers, and that's when we left that organization to start the Farm Workers Union.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about his legacy and whether or not you think even to this day he's gotten the respect, the recognition that he deserves.
No, I don't think so, because Cesar was really a genius. You know, he never went to high school. Mm-hmm. He only went to the eighth grade. He was very self-educated, always had a book under his arm, and he didn't really want any recognition for himself. When people would say, hey, you're the leader of the Chicano movement, he'd say, no, I am the president of the Farm Workers Union. And that was his commitment. His commitment was completely and totally to farm workers.
Mm-hmm. When you're fighting these fights all these years later, mm-hmm. How do you sustain your hope?
Well, we have to look and we can see what we have achieved. Yeah. We could see that what we're still doing, you know, that as long as people are organizing and going forward, we are making progress. And I know there's always these pushbacks, but you know, back in the 60s, it was pretty rough.
Yeah.
But all of the organizations then, the green organizations, the gay organization, the civil rights group, immigrant rights groups, a lot of us were just organizing then. And now we are institutionalized. So I think in many ways we're a lot stronger. And then we've got all of the devices, you know, you can get information mm-hmm. really quickly. You can mobilize and gather people. We've seen that with the protests on Black Lives Matter, on protests against Charlottesville, you know, on the Muslim ban.
Yeah.
You know, people can come together really quickly. But again, we just say to them, please vote. Okay, that's the important mm-hmm. thing. You know, please vote. And we have to get people to run for office like we do with the people that we organize. You know, make sure that we really support progressive candidates. And yeah. even get involved in your parties, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or a Green. You know, these are Democratic organizations. Mm-hmm. You can get in there with numbers and take those groups over to make sure that they support yeah. progressive candidates.
And what do you hope the takeaway is that people will get from watching this documentary, Dolores?
Well, we hope that people will get involved. You know, sometimes yeah. people have their private lives. You know, people are working hard, mm-hmm. you know, to earn a living, to feed their families. And they see this world out there of politics, and they don't think that that's their world. But everybody pays taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, we pay his salary. You know, your city council person, you know, your school board member. They, you know, we pay all of their salaries. So we have a voice and we have a say into what they are doing. And we've got to really check it out. We've got to pay attention and we've got to get involved. And sometimes it's just like sending a telegram.
Yeah.
I mean, not a telegram, email. Mm-hmm. I'm old school. Sending an email,
yeah.
like right now we've got SB 54, you know, to make this a sanctuary state, you
yeah.
know, to protect our undocumented people who, if they do a misdemeanor, they can be released from jail and not be turned over to ICE. Well, we just send an email to Governor Brown and say, sign this bill.
Yeah.
You know, we have other bills that are really important. One of them is unlawful defiance for our schools.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they still have it at the upper levels, you know, from sixth grade on.
Mm-hmm.
So we want that taken out.
Yeah.
You know, teenagers are teenagers. They're going to be defiant. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So don't kick them out of school because they're defiant. We want to get that bill passed, you know.
Yeah.
So just find out what's going on and, you know, listen to the news and the progressive, listen to Tavis Smiley.
Yeah, well.
Listen to Amy Goodman.
That'll get you in trouble.
You know, find out what's really going on and
yeah.
then engage, because we need you. We need every single person. If not, Donald Trump might be reelected
yeah,
if
well,
we don't get involved.
It's 2017 by the calendar I'm looking at, and all these mm-hmm. years later, Dolores Huerta is still on the battlefield, and not just on the battlefield, mm-hmm. on the front lines of the fight, and I love that. I've had the honor to travel with her in this country, okay. indeed around the world.
Right.
I've traveled with her, and I'm just honored to have her on the program, and I hope you'll check out this documentary called Dolores. Good to have you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter David Crosby is well known for his work with the iconic bands The Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. The two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Famer has just released a new album. It's called Sky Trails. He joins us now to reflect on his career and tell us more about the new project. Mr. Crosby, good to see you, my friend.
How are you, Tavis?
I'm wonderful. You doing all right?
I am doing well, thank you.
Glad to have you back. I want to start with a clip, which I warned you about, because I want to get your take on this, and then we'll jump into the music and all the other stuff you've been working on.
You betcha.
So your friend and brother, Graham Nash, was on this program. I asked him about your relationship, which I've been reading a lot about online, and this is what Graham Nash had to say on this program.
David and I have broken up as friends, yeah. You know? We have treated each other badly, and it's sad, but it's the way it is.
Can that breach be repaired?
I don't really know, you know. I don't have any desire to sing or make music with David, but I have to tell you, I'm a musician, first of all and foremost. And if David came to me with three or four songs that broke my heart, I'd have to do real serious thinking, because I am a musician, and I do want to put positive, wonderful stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And who knows? I don't know, you know. David and Stephen and Neil have been my brothers. I don't have brothers in my personal life, but they were my brothers. And sometimes we fight and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we rise to the heights and sometimes we don't. We're brothers. Right now, David and I are not talking.
Yeah. But if you're brothers, there's always hope. That's what that piano is about.
Yeah, there's always hope.
There's always hope.
There's always hope.
Yeah. I have seven brothers, some of whom I don't talk to every now and then when they upset me, but I love them all.
Yeah.
I love them all. How do you process that?
I think a number of things. I think he looks terrible, but I think he's right. You know, we used to be brothers, and I bear him no ill will. None of them. I made music with those guys that I'm extremely proud of.
Yeah.
A lot. You know, Graham and I probably were as good a singing pair, you know, harmony pair as mm-hmm. as the Everlys. I mean, we were excellent at it. Mm-hmm. And I treasure that. That's good work. We did good work. We don't get along. You know, there's a lifespan for bands. Bands start out and you're in love with each other, you're having fun, the songs are wonderful and you're excited and it's great. And if you're a success, it's rare, but it's wonderful. 40 years later, when it's devolved mm-hmm. to turn on the smoke machine and play your hits, it can get very tedious. It can get very, very hard. We don't really like each other, as you could tell mm-hmm. From how he was talking. It's difficult. I think that the pressure of economics keeps people at it longer than they should. Mm-hmm. Some bands can work it out. The Stones, hello, mm-hmm. you know. If Garcia hadn't died, the Dead would still be playing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in our case, I think we had a good run mm-hmm. and we did very good work. I bear Graham no ill will at all. Mm-hmm. But, okay, you mentioned the albums. I've had a burst of creativity since I left that band. And, you know, if there is a God and they put you here for any purpose, she put me here mm-hmm. to do music. Mm-hmm. and I'm making music just hand over fist as fast as I can.
Should we not be surprised, given what you said, David, and I take your point, given what you said, should we not be surprised, or put it another way, should we be surprised that the bands that do stay together make it as long as they do? Because to your point,
yeah, I think you should.
Over 40 years, that's a long time.
A long time.
To have that many people in a band who see, obviously, things creatively differently get along. It doesn't have to devolve to this point. But it is somewhat of a miracle that the bands that do stick together that long actually make it.
I think it is a miracle when they do make it. There are some people who are more adult than others.
Yeah.
I think if I'd been in a band with James Taylor, I'd still be in the band.
Right.
Yeah. You know, because he's just a sweetheart of a human being. I think it's all okay. Mm-hmm. I think there is one chance that we might get together again, which is Neil. Mm-hmm. If I hadn't ticked off Neil, I think CSNY still. And the reason being that I get an email every day, sometimes several, and I get a dozen tweets and some things on Facebook saying, "Hey, CSNY was our voice, you know, against the establishment, and you guys, you know, we need in Ohio, mm-hmm. get up off your lazy butts mm-hmm. and put your, you know, problems aside, get CSNY out there and be our voice." Fine, I'd love to. Mm-hmm. I like Neil. Neil just put out a very good record. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people that says never say never, because you just don't know.
So it sounds to me like, for all that's been said, you and Graham ended up at the same place, which is that there is still hope.
Yeah, sure.
That it might happen again.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. To your point now, David, it would seem to me, as you keep hearing from your fans, that if there were a chance that you all might reunite now, there couldn't be a more propitious time than now, given what's happening in the country, given what's happening in the world, in the era of Trump. And you guys have all had your own ways of speaking out about it individually. But how beautiful would it be in this moment when the country and the world needs to hear that
It would be a timely and good thing.
Yeah.
It would be us doing our job.
Yeah.
Part of our job has always been, man, to be the one who carries the news from town to town, mm-hmm. the troubadours.
Yeah.
That's where we come from.
Mm-hmm.
The town crier.
Yeah.
The it's 12:30 and you guys have elected an imbecile to run the country. That's our job, part of our job.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our job is to make you boogie.
Yeah.
And make you have fun and tell you emotional stories.
And you do both. You do both.
But every once in a while, that's part of our job.
Yeah.
And now would be a good time. Our country is in dire trouble. You saw those faces, Charlottesville.
Yeah.
You saw those guys with torches.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, for a long time in this country, we haven't been willing to admit that they were there.
Yeah.
And there they were.
Yeah.
And they were not hiding behind a sheet.
Yeah.
They were sneering directly at you and looking you right in the eye and saying, "I hate you." These are desperate times for this country, for democracy, which is a great idea.
You mentioned the burst of creativity that you've had since leaving the band and doing these solo projects, and indeed you have had a burst of creativity. The question I want to ask you that I've asked of others, but you'd be the person to ask, whether or not music is still pregnant with the kind of power that it once was back in the day to impact and to affect, to create the kind of change that it did back in the day.
Music. It's a wonderful tool for delivering ideas,
mm-hmm.
one of the best. So music now could be doing a great deal of good.
Mm-hmm.
I, a while ago, put out a tweet to go to everybody that I could think of, saying, mm-hmm. please, if you're a songwriter, I'm trying to write another song like Ohio, an inspirational song for now,
mm-hmm.
for what we're facing now, because our democracy is really seriously mm-hmm. under threat now. So we need one, and so I've been asking people, you know, if I can't do it, please you do it. I'm trying, but mm-hmm. please, we need that song, and it's true. We can at our best.
Mm-hmm.
function, you know, the way We Shall Overcome functioned. Mm-hmm. We can inspire you to get up and stand up for what you believe in, and the country needs it.
Let me ask, I'm going to struggle here, and I apologize to you and to the audience in advance. I'm going to struggle trying to get this question out, but just give me a second here, and I think I may get there in 30 seconds or so. So that David Crosby is a great songwriter. Prince was a great songwriter. Stevie Wonder is a great songwriter. So when you say that you're trying to write that song, I assume the gift doesn't just magically disappear into thin air. So what happens with the gift of songwriting that allows one to write a bunch of hits in a particular era, but then fight to find that same. You sure I'm getting at here?
I do. I see what you're getting at, but it's not that simple.
Okay, that's why I said I was going to struggle with
it. Here's how it works.
Okay,
you can, at the right time, have a run of writing that makes hits. I have never had any hits. I've been in bands that have had hits, mm-hmm. lots of them, but I don't generally write hits. What happens is each time you write, it's a brand new experience. Mm-hmm. Trying to write a song about something this critical is very difficult. And you can't go right at it. If you want to describe the Eiffel Tower, you don't write a song that says it's big and it's tall and it's made out of iron.
I got you.
So you don't go right at it.
Is that why my songs aren't working?
Yes,
Is that the problem?
I've been trying to tell you, Ted. You go at it from the view of somebody who's looking up through the mist of Paris at the Eiffel Tower over the head of their lover, mm-hmm. whom they're seeing in the fog. You look at it from somebody's eyes. Mm-hmm. You personalize it, you humanize it, you find a way into it, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
And when you're writing a song about something that's wrong, it's very difficult not to be preachy. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a preacher. Mm-hmm. I'm a person who can say, that's wrong. When America starts shooting its own children, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. We got a problem. And that's Ohio. And we did right. Mm-hmm. That was a great song that did a right thing. I believe in the power of music. I believe in the power of ideas. And music's a great way to deliver ideas. So I'm still trying to write the song for now, mm-hmm. because I feel right now we're as challenged as a country as we have ever been.
Yeah. I've often wondered about that, because I mean, obviously I'm a music lover, as you know. But I look at these great songwriters who in a particular era, they can do nothing wrong. I mean, anything they put on paper.
They hit a hot streak.
But I've always been tripped up by the fact that it's the same person, you have the same skill, the gift didn't just dissipate, but why does it work in one era, and 40 years later, you're trying to write another hit?
Tavis, if I could tell you, I would.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of factors. Yeah. I think it's a very complex thing.
I mean, timing is part of it, but I get that. Yeah.
But I think, you know, people get lazy.
Yeah.
A guy can have a string of hits and then just get lazy, or get, you know, convince themselves that they can't do it, or mm-hmm. there's so many ways it can go wrong. You can start doing hard drugs and lose your track completely.
Yeah.
I did, and I stopped writing completely.
Yeah.
The more drugs I did, the less I wrote until I stopped writing.
Yeah.
And I quit, and the writing came back. That tells you everything you need to know right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to write. You have to work at it. I work at it every day. Every single day of my life, I pick up the guitar and I fool around and try to see. I go, yoo-hoo, Muse, are you out there? Come on over.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm awake.
Yeah.
You know, try to tickle it into happening. You can't take it for granted, and you can't sit on your laurels.
Yeah.
And you can't count your hits.
Yeah.
You have to think about today. And if you have stuff that really matters to you to say, and I got stuff that really matters to me to say, then you have to work at it. I may or may not succeed, but I've been writing a lot, so
yeah.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Speaking of great songwriters, I started looking at the liner notes for this, and I about fell off my seat when I saw Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Well, she's the best.
Yeah, you talked to her. Yeah, of course. I was saying, speaking of great songwriters, good Lord. I mean,
yeah.
You got Joni Mitchell. Yeah.
I think Joni Mitchell is the greatest living singer songwriter.
Yeah.
I produced her first record. We went together for about a year.
Yeah.
I love her. I still love her. I think she's the best. I think it's her and Bob, wonderful old weird Bob.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to be on here.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get Bob on.
Yeah. Bob doesn't like to talk.
He's fun, though.
Yeah. He's a great writer. He don't like to talk very much.
I know, but he's fun, Cat.
Yeah.
He likes being mysterious.
Yeah.
But it's Bob and Joni, and she's a better singer.
Yeah.
Always has been a better musician than mm-hmm. him. I love her. I wish her well. I hope she will recover completely.
Yeah. So do I. Live a long time. So speaking of Joni, you got some great stuff on here.
That song of hers is one I've been wanting to sing my whole, ever since she wrote it.
Yeah.
And I haven't been actually scared of it.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure I could cut it.
Scared of it? What scared you about it?
It's such a magnificent piece of music, man.
Yeah.
The way she wrote about her, the way she wrote about Amelia Earhart and her own love life at the same time on two layers. Mm-hmm. So beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful piece of work. I wasn't sure I was up to it, but I couldn't resist it.
To your point earlier, you do get a burst of creativity, but how do you put stuff out that the audience will love, but that isn't a repeat of something you've done before because you've done everything already?
Well, songs.
Yeah.
You can't, like, try to duplicate what you did.
Right.
People spend, in our
but,
business.
But the record industry wants that these days.
Well,
they want the same hit over and over
again.
Oh, man,
those guys, you know, the guys who run the record industry are failed shoe salesmen.
Yeah.
They have not a single, they have not one clue about songs.
And no talent. Yeah,
no
yeah.
talent.
Yeah, yeah,
no
yeah.
idea of what a song is.
Right.
No idea of what music is at all.
Right.
And they're trying to sell it. But you can't go by that. I don't pay a lot of attention to the music business.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty depressing for us, man. You know, streaming killed records. We don't get to sell records anymore. I lost half my business, half my income, half my musical life. I'm still making records, but I'm making it out of the grocery money, and I'm making them because they're my art. They're what I do.
Yeah.
They're what I'll leave behind. They're my life's work. They don't matter anymore in terms of, you know, it's done. Streaming just killed it.
Yeah.
The streaming people sell our music and don't pay us for it.
So simple. So how do you get motivated then to do something like Sky Trails?
Songs.
Yeah.
I love the songs.
Yeah.
I love singing to people. I love songs. I love communicating. And I got stuff I want to say about love, about people. People fascinate me, man.
How would you describe what Sky Trails is as a project?
You know, Sky Trails, okay, I have two guys that I work with as producers currently. One is my son, James Raymond, who produced this record.
Yep.
Who is a brilliant producer. I mean, he's a brilliant writer, a brilliant player, and a wonderful human being, and a great record producer. He and I started collecting songs for this while I was still making the last one, Lighthouse, which was produced by Michael League, who's the other guy that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
This one, James and I, we knew we had several songs that we liked a lot. So we started, you know, collecting to put it together for this, a year ago at least. And I think we succeeded.
Yeah. I mentioned Joni Mitchell earlier. There's some Michael McDonald stuff on here, too.
Yeah.
You got some great songwriters, man.
Oh, well, he's a hero of mine.
Yeah.
I think Michael's one of the two best singers in the country.
Yeah.
Him and Stevie.
Yeah.
I think Stevie Wonder. You know, I have a low opinion of Kanye West.
Yes, I read your tweets.
So,
as has the rest of the country. It's not just Kanye. You got some trouble just bashing hip hop, period, across the board.
Oh, some of them.
Yeah.
There's people. Lin-Manuel's brilliant.
Yeah.
You can't knock that, man. If that's rap, rap is glorious.
Mm-hmm.
There's other people.
Please don't say Macklemore again.
Don't say it.
Macklemore. No, don't say it again.
Don't say it again.
You don't want to fight me about that. I love you. We are not going to fight
but
if you put Macklemore on your top three list.
No.
We are not going to fight
I'm going to put Lin-Manuel. Now, let's talk about him.
I'll let you do that.
Because he's good.
He is. He's great. He's great. And I love him. The only thing I'd say to you about that is that, you know, with all due respect to Lin, brother's been doing this for a long time.
Mm.
Lin is part of a tradition. And when you raise Lin-Manuel Miranda above all these other brothers, when you read Lin's book, Lin raises Biggie.
Yeah, I know he did.
Lin raises...
I know he did.
Pac. Lin, you see my point?
But Lin's a better writer than they were.
See, we're going to have another fight, David.
Bring it.
See,
bring it, baby.
I'm trying to help you here, man.
Bring it.
And tomorrow you're going to get blitzed again on social
again.
Media.
Again, it's going to come down on me.
I'm trying to help you, man. I'm trying to help you.
No, it's like any bunch of people, man. There's some really talented people there.
Yeah.
And there's some people who are just a joke, yeah. You know, and just like.
But that's true of every industry, every genre.
Every single part of the.
We agree on that. In every genre, there are people
absolutely.
Who are brilliant, folk who ought to go sit down somewhere.
Really ought to.
Right. Take a few seats.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
stay there.
Yeah.
Go to sleep.
Yeah.
It's not my form. It's not an art form that appeals to me that much. You mm-hmm. know, I can see exceptional cases where it does move me, but
right.
rarely. But I don't like opera either.
Yeah.
You guys, you rappers, you should know that. I don't like opera either.
You're not alone, huh?
No. You're not alone. I'm not
yeah.
singling you out.
Yeah, yeah,
I think
yeah.
opera sucks.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not real fond of country pop either.
Yeah.
I like Alison Krauss and Union Station
yeah.
for country music.
Alice's
I think
good.
That's
yeah.
really good stuff.
Yeah. But that's the great thing about music. We're all entitled to have our own tastes.
Yeah. And it's fine.
And to like what we like.
Yeah. And it's fine.
Yeah.
You know? Thank God there's all these different kinds of art out there,
yeah.
man. That's one of the things, one of the only good things that's happening from having the Orange Nightmare in Washington.
Yeah.
It's,
you got the Orange Nightmare?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure I heard you correctly. Okay. Yeah.
It's that it's generating some good art.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the great Paul Robeson and his quote, which I just hold on to every day.
There's a hero for you.
Yeah, exactly. And Robeson says that artists are the gatekeepers of truth.
He was right.
And so in this moment, that's what you look for.
Yeah.
Are the artists who are willing to tell the truth?
We need the artists who are willing to stand up for what they believe in. And if you believe in this country, and a lot of them say they do, now's the time.
Fair enough. Sky Trails is a new project from David Crosby. It's a good one. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.